Chapter 5. Covered Traces. The Glaws of Gudrun. Unwelcome Companions. Deafened by the blast, I had wit enough left to grab Fischig and roll with him out through the terraced doors as the emergency shutter clanked down from its slit in the hardwood ceiling. We lay panting and half-blind on the terrace, the hard light and warmth of the sun dome thawing our cold-shocked bodies. Alarms and warning bells sounded all along the Thorview residences. Our BT's units were already on their way. We got up. Our clothes and simple good fortune had protected us from the worst of the glass storm, though I had a gash straight down my left cheek that would need closing, and Fischig had a long splinter of glass embedded in his thigh between armour joints. Apart from that, we had just superficial scratches.
"Bad timing?"
he asked, though he knew it wasn't. The charges were set off by the same spasm that killed Croats. He glanced away and rebuckled one of his gauntlets, giving himself time to think. His face was a dingy grey colour, mainly through shock, but I think he was now beginning to understand the resources and capabilities of the people we worked against. Their abominable crime at Processional 212 had demonstrated the scale of their malice, but he hadn't seen that firsthand. Now he was witnessing the fanatical servants of a dark cause, men who would fight without hesitation, to the death. And he had seen how brutally they would cover their traces, using mental weapons and brain-wired booby traps that spoke of vast resources and frightening sophistication. RBT's squads moved into the dwelling and secured it while local Medicaid servitors patched our wounds. The clearance squads brought out the shivering girl, Bequin. She was wrapped in blankets and her face was pinched blue with cold. Under my seal and instruction, they placed her in custody. She was too cold to voice a complaint. Fischig and I re-entered wearing heat gowns. It would be another 2 or 3 hours before engineer teams could replace the outer shutter. From the harsh light of the terrace, we passed through 3 hastily hung insulation curtains into the dim, blue twilight of the apartment. The far wall was gone, and we looked directly into the clear, glassy night of Hubris, a glossy grey landscape of stark shadows and backscattered light stretching away from the edge of the sun dome. Once more I was exposed to the piercing cold of dormant, and my blood ached. The main room where we had questioned Croats was a gutted cavity, blackened by soot and jewelled with glass. Hard lacquers of frost caked furniture surfaces and twisted the faces of the dead. Blood spilt by the shredding storm of glass was crusted like rubies in the dark. We played the smoky white beams of our lamps around. I doubted we would find much now. There was a good chance any valuable documents had been set to burn or delete on the same trigger signal that had blown the shutter and killed Croats. And it also seemed likely these people carried all truly important information internally, as memory engrams or meme codes, the sort of techniques usually reserved for the higher echelons of diplomatic corps, the administratum and elite trade delegations. That turned my mind back to Croats's employer, the Guild Synesias.
"It's a common enough name in this subsector," Amos told me back in the comfortable half-light of the gun cutter in its landing platform berth. He had been researching the name Pontius. "I've turned up over 500,000 citizens with that forename, another 200,000 with it as a middle name, plus another 40,000 or 50,000 spelling variants."
He waved a data slate at me. I brushed it aside and used a hand mirror to study the line of metal butterfly sutures in the wound in my cheek. "What about the definite article?"
"I have over 9,000 marks with that connection," he sighed.
He began to read them from his slate list.
"The Pontius Swellwyn Youth Academy. The Pontius Praxiteles Translation Bureau. The Pontius Givant Ropus Investment Financiary. The Pontius Spiegel Microsurgical Hospital."
"Enough," I sat at the codifier, typing in name groups. Flickering runes hunted and darted across the viewplate. Text extracts drifted into focus. I searched through them by eye, my finger resting on the scroll bar. "Pontius Glaw," I said. He blinked and looked at me. There was a half-smile of scholarly delight on his narrow face.
"Not on my lists."
"Because he is dead?"
"Because he's dead."
Amos came over and looked across my shoulder at the screen.
"But it makes a sort of sense."
It did. a kind of illogic that had the flavour of truth, the sort of spore an inquisitor gets a nose for after a few years. The Glore family was old blood, a thrusting noble dynasty that had been a main player in this subsector for almost a millennium. The primary familial holdings and estates were on Gudrun, a world that had already come to our attention. House Glore was also a major shareholder and investor in the regal bonded merchant guild of Synesius, so the codifier had just revealed to me.
Pontius Glore, I murmured.
Pontius Glore had been dead for more than 200 years. The seventh son of Oberon Glore, one of the great patriarchs of that line, he had suffered the fate of most junior siblings in that there had been precious little for him to inherit once his older brothers had taken their turn. His eldest brother, another Oberon, had become lord of the house. The second eldest had been gifted with the control of the stockholdings. The third had taken on the captaincy of the house militia. The fourth and fifth had married politically and entered the administratum at high level. And so it went. From what I remembered of Pontius Glore's biography, required reading as a trainee, Pontius had become a dilettante, wasting his life, his robust virility, charisma, and finely educated intellect in all manner of worthless pursuits. He had gambled away a significant measure of his personal fortune, then rebuilt it on the revenues of slave trading and pit fighting. A ruthless sliver of brutality stained his record. And then, in his 40s, with his health ruined by years of abuse, he turned to a much darker path. It has always been suspected that this turn was triggered by some chance event, an artifact or document that fell into his hands, perhaps the strange beliefs of some of the more barbaric pit fighters he enslaved. Instinct told me the propensity had always been within him, and that he was looking for a chance to let it flourish. It is documented he was a lifelong collector of rare and often prohibited books. At what point might his appetite for licentious and esoteric pornography have spilled over into the heretical and blasphemous? Pontius Glore became a disciple of chaos, a devotee of the most abominable and obscene forces that haunt this galaxy. He drew a coven around him, and over a period of 15 years committed unspeakable and increasingly brazen acts of evil. He was slain eventually, his coven along with him, on Lamsarot, by an inquisitorial purge led by the great Absalon Angevin. House Glore participated in this overthrow, desperate to be seen to distance themselves from his crimes. It is likely this alone prevented the entire family from being pulled down with him. A monster, a notorious monster, and dead, as Amos had been so quick to point out, dead for more than 2 centuries. But the name and the connection of facts seemed too obvious to ignore. I wandered up to the cockpit and sat with Betancourt.
"We'll need passage off-world. To Gudrun."
"I'll arrange it. It may be a day or two."
"As fast as you can." I sent word to High Custodian Carpel, informing him of some, though not all, of my findings, and telling him I would shortly be leaving to continue my investigations on Gudrun. I was reading through the confidential case records of Inquisitor Angevin when 2 Arbites brought Bequin to my gun cutter. I had sent orders for her to be delivered into my charge. She stood in the crew bay, frowning in the gloom, cuffed. She had dressed in a tawdry gown and a light cloak, but despite the cheapness of her garb and the discomfort she was in, her considerable beauty was plain to see. Good bones, a full mouth, fierce eyes and long dark hair. Yet, again, there was that air about her, that tone I had detected before. Despite her obvious physical attractions, there was something almost repellent about her. It was curious, but I was convinced I knew what it was. She glanced round as I entered the crew bay, her expression a mix of fear and indignation.
"I helped you," she spat.
"You did, though I neither asked for nor needed your help." She pouted. That air was stronger now, an unpleasant feeling that made me want to bundle her out of the cutter and have done with her there and then.
"The Arbites say they will charge me with murder and conspiracy."
"The Arbites desperately want someone to pin the crimes on. You are unhappily involved in those matters, though I don't believe deliberately."
"Damn right," she snarled. "This has ruined me, my life here, just when I was getting things together."
"Your life has been difficult?" She fixed me with a sneer that questioned my intelligence. I'm a pleasure girl, an object, it seemed to say. Lowest of the low. How difficult do you think my life has been? I stepped forward and removed the Arbiti's cuffs. She rubbed her wrists and looked at me in surprise. Sit down, I told her. I was using the will. She looked at me again, as if wondering what the funny tone was all about, and then calmly took a seat on a padded leather bench along the crew bay's back wall. I can make sure the charges are dropped, I told her. I have that authority. Indeed, my authority is the only reason you haven't been charged or interrogated so far.
Why would you do that?
I thought you believed I owed you.
Doesn't matter what I believe.
There was a sullen cast to her face as she looked me up and down. I found myself intrigued. Objectively, I was looking at a girl whose looks and vivacious spirit made her undeniably desirable.
Yet I almost wanted to shout at her, to drive her away, to get her out of my sight. I had an entirely unwarranted and instinctive loathing for her.
Even if you clear me, I can't carry on here. They'll hound me out. I'll be marked as trouble. That'll be the end of my work. I'll have to move on again. She stared down at the floor and muttered a curse.
Just when I was getting it together.
Move on. You're not from Hubris.
This miserable shit pit.
Where then?
I came here from Thracian Primaris, 4 years ago.
You were born on Thracian?
She shook her head. Bonaventure.
That was half a sector away. How did you get from Bonaventure to Thracian?
By way of this and that, here and there. I've travelled a lot. Never stayed put very long.
Because things get difficult.
The sneer again. That's right. I'd stuck it out here longer than anywhere. Now that's all screwed up.
Stand up, I snapped suddenly, using the will again. She paused and shrugged at me.
Make your mind up.
She got to her feet. I want to ask you some questions about the men who employed you at Thorview 12011.
I thought you might.
If you answer helpfully, I can cut you a deal.
What sort of deal?
I can take you to Gudrun, give you a chance to make a new start. Or I can offer you employment, if you're interested. She smiled quizzically. It was the first positive expression I had seen on her. It made her more beautiful, but I didn't like her any better.
Employment? You'd employ me. An inquisitor would employ me.
That's right. Certain services I think you can provide. She took two fluid steps over to me and placed her hands flat against my chest.
I see, she said. Even big bad inquisitors have needs, huh? That's fine.
You misunderstand, I replied, pushing her back as politely as I could. Physical contact with her made the unnatural feeling of revulsion even stronger. The services I have in mind will be new to you. Not the sort of work you are accustomed to. Are you still interested? She set her head on one side and considered me.
You're an odd one, all right. Are all inquisitors like you?
No. I ordered the servitor Modo to provide her with refreshment and left her in the crew bay. Betancourt was stood in the shadows outside the door, gazing in at her appreciatively.
She's a fine sight, he murmured to me, as if I might not have noticed.
You forget Vibben so quickly.
He snapped round at me, stung. That was low, Eisenhorn. I was just commenting.
You'll like her less when you get to know her. She's an untouchable.
Seriously?
Seriously. A psychic blank. It's natural, and I haven't tested her limits. It's all I can do to be in the same room as her.
Such a looker, too,
Betancourt sighed, gazing back in at her. Useful to us. If she passes certain requirements, I'm going to employ her. He nodded. Untouchables were rare, and almost impossible to create artificially. They have a negative presence in the warp that renders them virtually immune to psychic powers, which in turn makes them potent anti-psycho weapons. The side effect of their psychic blankness is the unpleasant disturbance that accompanies them, the waves of fear and revulsion they trigger in those they meet. No wonder her life had been difficult and friendless.
News? I asked Betancourt. Made contact with a sprint trader called the SN.
Master's one Tobias Maxilla. Deals in small units of luxury goods. Coming here in 2 days to deliver a consignment of vintage wines from Hesperus, then on to Gudrun. For a fee, he'll make room for the cutter in his hold.
Good work. So, we'll be on Gudrun when?
2 weeks.
I spent the next hour or so interviewing Bequin, but as I suspected, she knew precious little about any of the men. We gave her accommodation in a small bunk cell next to Betancourt's quarters. It was scarcely more than a box, and Nilquit had to remove piles of stowed equipment to clear it. But she seemed pleased enough. When I asked her if she had any possessions she wished to collect from the Sundome, she simply shook her head. I was reviewing yet more piles of data with Amos when Fischig arrived. He was dressed in his brown serge uniform suit and carried 2 bulky holdalls over his shoulder, which he dropped to the deck with a declamatory thump as he stepped aboard. "To what do I owe this visit, Chastener?" I asked. He showed me a slate bearing Carpel's official seal.
"The High Custodian grants you permission to leave to pursue your inquiry. Dependent on this."
I reviewed the slate and sighed.
"I'm coming with you," he said.